Sketch for an Historical Picture of the Advances of the Human Mind by Nicolas de Condorcet. Ninth Era. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Ninth Era. From the Time of Descartes to the Formation of the French Republic. We have seen human reason being formed slowly by the natural advances of civilization, superstition taking it over so as to corrupt it, and despotism degrading it and slowing minds down by loading them with fear and suffering. Only one nation escaped this double influence. In that happy land, where liberty had just lit the torch of genius, the human mind, freed from the baby harness of its infancy, advanced towards the truth with a firm step. But conquest soon introduced tyranny, followed by its inseparable companion, superstition, and the whole race of man is plunged back into darkness, which is apparently going to last forever. However, daylight returned very gradually. Eyes long condemned to darkness blinked open and shut, getting used to the light until they could look straight at it, and high intelligence ventured to reappear on the globe, from which fanaticism and barbarity had for so long banished it. We have seen reason lightening its chains by getting rid of some of them, and preparing and hastening its moment of liberty by steadily acquiring new forces. We have now to go through the era in which it finally breaks them, in which it gets rid of them, one by one, in which, free at last to go its way, it can't be held up except by obstacles such as are inevitable with each new advance, results of the very conformation of our intelligence, or obstacles that nature has placed in the way of our discovering the truth, that is, no obstacles resulting from human actions or attitudes. Religious intolerance had forced seven of the Belgian provinces to throw off Spain's yoke and form themselves into a federal republic. The same cause had revived a spirit of liberty in England, which, tired of long and bloody commotions, finally settled for a constitution that was for a long time admired by philosophy, but is now reduced to having no support except national superstition and political hypocrisy. Lastly, the Swedish nation. It was priestly persecution that gave them the fortitude to seize back some of their rights. Yet France, Spain, Hungary, and Bohemia, amidst the commotions caused by theological quarrels, had seen the annihilation of their feeble liberties, or at least of what looked like liberties. In the countries said to be free, it would be useless to look for the freedom that harms none of the natural rights of man. It doesn't merely affirm that man has those rights, but also lets him exercise them. The liberty found in those countries is based on a man-made right that is unequally shared. What privileges it grants to a given man depends on what town he lives in, what class he was born into, how rich he is, or how he makes his living. The best answer we can give to anyone who still maintains that these bizarre distinctions are useful and necessary will be to present a picture showing them, and thus showing how different they are in different nations. But in these countries, civic and personal liberty are guaranteed by the laws. If in them man isn't all that he ought to be, still the dignity of his nature is not totally degraded. Some of his rights are at least recognized. He can't any longer be called a slave. Only someone who doesn't yet know how to be truly free. In nations where during this period liberty suffered more or less real losses, the political rights enjoyed by the mass of the people were so restricted that the loss of them seems to have been more than made up for by the annihilation of the almost arbitrary aristocracy under which they had groaned. They have lost the title citizen, which inequality had made almost illusory. But the status of man has been more respected, and royal despotism has saved them from feudal oppression, rescuing them from that state of humiliation. The laws were bound to improve in half-free constitutions, because in those the interests of the power-holders are not always at variance with the general interests of the people, and they improved in despotic states, because the public's prosperity is sometimes mixed up with the despot's, or because the despot, in trying to destroy the remaining authority of the nobles or the clergy, introduces a spirit of equality into the laws. In the latter case, the motive was to establish an equality of slavery, but the results were often salutary. In the longer work, of which this one is a sketch, I shall expound in detail the causes that have produced in Europe a type of despotism that has not appeared at any earlier time or in any other place. It involved an almost arbitrary authority that was restrained by opinion, governed by enlightenment, and tempered by its own interests, and it has often contributed to the advances of wealth, industry, education, and sometimes even to the advances of civil liberty. Men's manners and morals were softened by the decay of the prejudices that had kept them fierce, by the influence of commerce and industry, natural enemies of the disorder and violence that scare away wealth, by the horror induced by still fresh mental pictures of the barbarities of the preceding era, by a more general diffusion of the philosophical ideas of equality and humanity, and lastly by the slow but sure effect of the general progress of enlightenment. Religious intolerance survived, but as a prudent human invention, as a homage to the people's prejudices, or as a safeguard against emotional outbreaks from them. It had its ferocity. Burning at the stake, seldom resorted to, was replaced by oppression that was often more arbitrary, though less barbaric. And in these recent times, persecution appeared only here or there, as an upshot of mere habit or of complacency. The behaviour of governments everywhere had reluctantly followed, on all topics, the footsteps of opinion and even of philosophy. In the political and moral sciences, the level of insight reached by the philosophers is always far above the intermediate level reached by the general run of thinking men, whose shared views constitute what is called opinion, while those who direct the affairs of a nation, whatever its form of government, are at a lower level still. They follow opinion, but without catching up, let alone getting ahead, they are always below it, many years below it, many truths below it. So now the picture of the philosophical advances and of the spread of knowledge, whose most general and perceptible effects I have expounded, leads us into an era in which the influence of these advances on opinion, and of opinion on nations or on their leaders, suddenly stopped being gradual and imperceptible, and produced a revolution in the entire populace of certain nations, a secure pledge of the revolution that is bound to embrace the whole human species. After ages of error, after wandering lost among vague and incomplete theories, writers on law at last came to know the true rights of man, deriving them from this simple truth: man is a sentient being, capable of reasoning and of acquiring moral ideas. They saw that the sole purpose of men's coming together in political societies was to maintain these rights, and that the art of society ought to be the art of preserving them, with no inequalities and no exceptions. They saw that the means of securing the rights of each individual should be governed by general rules laid down in his community, so that the power of choosing these means and determining these rules could belong only to the majority of the members of that community. Why? Because in this choice, no individual can follow his own reason without imposing it on others. So the only principle that can be followed by all without harming equality is the will of the majority. Each man can commit himself in advance to comply with the will of the majority, and this, if everyone does it, turns the will of the majority into unanimity. But he can't commit anyone else, and he can't even commit himself to the majority, except on the condition that it won't violate his individual rights after having recognized them. Such are the rights of the majority over the society or its members, and the limits of these rights. Such is the origin of the unanimity that makes all the majority's decisions obligatory for every one, an obligation that ceases to hold when the unanimity ceases to exist because of a change of individuals. No doubt there are issues on which the majority might more often than not decide wrongly, that is, against the common interest, but what these topics are that oughtn't to be directly settled by majority decisions is something that only the majority can decide. And it alone can determine who the individuals are whose judgment it will prefer to its own, and set the rules for how those individuals are to go about this business. And it can't dodge its responsibility for pronouncing whether those individuals' decisions have harmed the rights that are common to all. These simple principles were seen to abolish the idea of there being between a people and its magistrates a contract that could be annulled only by mutual consent or by a violation of the conditions by one of the parties, and to abolish the opinion, less servile but equally absurd, that once a constitution has been established, the people are chained to it, as if the right of changing it were not the primary guarantee of every other right, and as if human institutions, necessarily defective and capable of improvement, as men learn more, were condemned to last for ever. So it was seen that one had to give up that sneaky and false political theory which, forgetting that the very nature of men gives them equal rights, would in some places apportion rights to countries on the basis of the size of territory, the climate, the national character, the wealth of the populace, or the state of commerce and industry, and in other places grant these rights unequally within countries across the different classes of society, according to birth, fortune, or profession. So they no longer ventured to divide mankind into two species, one destined to govern, the other to obey, one destined to lie, the other to be deceived. And they had to recognize that all men have an equal right to know all the truths regarding all their interests, and that no power established by the people for the people can be entitled to hide anything from the people. These principles, for which the generous Algernon Sidney paid with his life, and to which Locke gave the authority of his name, were later developed with greater force, precision, and extent by Rousseau, who earned the glory of placing them among the truths it is no longer permissible to forget or dispute. Man has needs, and abilities to provide for them, and the output of these abilities is a mass of goods that can provide for the community's needs. Three questions arise. First, what are the laws governing how these goods are formed or distributed, conserved or consumed, increased or diminished? Second, what are the laws of the equilibrium between needs and resources that continually tends to be established? This equilibrium involves a frightening complication of interests, connecting a single individual's survival and well-being to his society's general system, making him dependent on all the stray events of nature and of politics. Which leads to the third question. How can one see, by a general law of the moral world, that each individual's efforts on his own behalf serve the good of the whole, and that despite the clash of opposing interests, the common interest requires that each individual should understand his own interest and be free to pursue it without hindrance? Thus, man ought to be able to employ his faculties, dispose of his goods, and provide for his needs in complete freedom. The general interest of his society, so far from restraining him in this respect, forbids any attempt to restrain him. In this department of public order, the care of securing to every man the rights he derives from nature is the only sound policy, the only duty of society as a whole, and the only law that the general will is entitled to exercise over individuals. But once this principle is acknowledged, the public power still has some duties to fulfil. It has to make laws, laying down the measures to be used for the weight, volume, width, and length of things that are exchanged. It has to create a common measure of values that can represent any value. This can make it easier to compare and calculate values. And when it comes to have a value of its own, it can be used as the medium of exchange for everything that can be exchanged. Without this, commerce would be confined to direct barter, and would inevitably be very sluggish. Each year's output has a portion that is dispensable, in that it isn't earmarked to pay for the work that produced it, or work that will have an equal or better output in time to come. This is the portion of the people's annual income that the sovereign authority can, without infringing on anyone's rights, avail itself of to meet the expenses of the state's security, its internal tranquillity, securing the rights of individuals, the work of the authorities set up to create or administer law, and finally, the maintenance of public prosperity. There are works, establishments, and institutions that are beneficial to society as a whole, and that society ought to establish, direct, or superintend. I'm talking about institutions, etc., to handle matters that can't be dealt with immediately by personal inclinations or the coming together of individual interests. Matters such as making advances in agriculture, industry, and commerce, and preventing or mitigating the evils that nature inevitably brings, or ones that unforeseen events add to those. Up to the start of this ninth era, and even for a long time after, these various matters had been left to chance, to the greed of governments, to the skill of charlatans, or to the prejudices and self-interest of the powerful classes. A brilliant Dutch politician, a disciple of Descartes, saw that political economy, like every other science, should be governed by the principles of philosophy and by precise calculation. But political economy made little progress until the Peace of Utrecht promised to Europe a durable tranquillity. At that time, many minds started to attend to this previously neglected subject, and this new science was raised by James Stewart, Adam Smith, and above all, at least as regards precision and purity of principles, the French economists, to a level that couldn't have been expected so soon after that long period of neglect. The main cause of these advances in politics and political economy was the advances in general philosophy, that is, in metaphysics, taking this word in its broadest sense. Descartes had restored metaphysics to the domain of reason. He had seen that it should come entirely from the evident and primary truths revealed to us by investigating the operations of our mind. But it didn't take long for his eager imagination to lead him off the path that he had mapped, and philosophy seemed for a while to be using its newly regained independence only to wander around among new errors. Eventually Locke grasped the thread needed to show the way back. He showed that a precise and accurate analysis of ideas, reducing them stepwise to ideas more immediate in their origin or simpler in their structure, was the only way to avoid being lost in the chaos of incomplete, incoherent, and vague notions that have come to us haphazardly and been received by us without reflection. He showed by this analysis that all our ideas result from the operations of our intellect on the sensations we have received, or, more precisely, result from sensations that our memory presents us with simultaneously, but in such a way that our attention is fixed and our perception limited to some part of each of these composite sensations. He showed that by attaching one word to each idea, properly analysed and defined, we become able to recall constantly the same idea, that is, the upshot of the same simple ideas kept within the same limits, which lets us use it in a train of reasoning without risk of going astray. Whereas if our words don't each represent one fixed and definite idea, they can at different times call up different ideas to the mind, which is the main source of our errors. In short, Locke was the first who ventured to fix the limits of human intelligence, or rather to determine the nature of the truths it can know and the objects it can grasp. This method was soon adopted by all the philosophers, and it was by applying it to morals, politics, and public economy that they became able in these sciences to follow a path almost as secure as that of the natural sciences, to admit only conclusions that could be proved, separating these from anything that might still be doubtful and uncertain, and to settle for not knowing anything that is, and always will be, unknowable. Thus the analysis of our feelings showed us that the development of our capacity for feeling pleasure and pain is the source of our moral ideas, the basis of the general truths which, being derived from those ideas, fix the unchanging necessary laws of right and wrong, and showed us the proper motives of obeying those laws, motives that are drawn from the very nature of our sensibility, that is, from our moral constitution, so to speak. The same method became a kind of all-purpose instrument. They used it to improve the methods of the physical sciences, to clarify principles and to evaluate proofs of them, and they extended it to testing factual claims in history and to laws of taste. So this metaphysic, being brought to bear on every topic humans can think about, revealed for each branch of knowledge the process of the human mind in it, the nature of the truths that form it into a system, and what kind of certainty can be achieved in it. It's the third of these that has, in a way, placed an everlasting barrier between the human race and the old mistakes of its infancy. It guarantees the collapse of prejudices that we now have, including ones we aren't even aware of, and it ought to prevent us from being dragged back into our earlier ignorance by new prejudices, ones that might replace the old ones, but now can have only a brief, feeble influence. In Germany, however, a man of wide and deep intelligence laid the foundations of a new doctrine. His bold and ardent imagination couldn't settle for a modest philosophy that left unanswered those great questions of the spirituality or survival of the human soul, the freedom of man and of God, and the existence of vice and misery in a universe governed by an omnipotent, thinking being whose justice and goodness should, one might think, lead him to rule them out. Leibniz cut the knot that a learned analysis wouldn't have been able to untie. He supposed the universe to be composed of simple, indestructible beings equal by their very nature. The qualities that distinguish any one of these from all the others are determined by how it relates to all the others within the system of the universe. The human soul, and the smallest detectable particle of matter, are each one of these monads, as Leibniz called them. They differ only through their different places in the order of the universe. Of all the possible combinations of these beings, an infinite intelligence chose one, and couldn't have chosen any other, because this is the most perfect of all. If we are afflicted by the spectacle of misery and vice in the existing universe, the fact is that any other combination would have produced even greater evils. This system was adopted, or at least supported, by Leibniz's countrymen, and slowed down the advances of philosophy in that part of the world. In England, there arose a whole school of philosophers who enthusiastically accepted and eloquently defended the doctrine that this is the best possible world. But they hadn't Leibniz's skill or depth. Whereas he based the doctrine primarily on the thesis that an omnipotent thinking being couldn't, by the very necessity of its, or his, nature, have chosen any but the best of the possible universes, the English tried to show the perfection of our world by looking into the facts about it. This led to their losing the advantages that this system has when considered generally, and in the abstract, and often to their wandering around among details that were either revolting or ridiculous. In Scotland, however, other philosophers, not finding that the analysis of the faculties we do have led to anything providing a sufficiently solid and pure basis for the morality of our actions, credited the human soul with a new faculty, distinct from those of sensation and reason, but combining with them. Their only evidence for the existence of this new faculty was their insistence that they couldn't do without it. These opinions, while slowing the onward march of philosophy, have done good in speeding up the spread of philosophical ideas. Up to here, I have exhibited the advances of philosophy only among men who have cultivated it, deepened it, improved it. It remains to show what its effects on general opinion have been, and how reason, while coming to know the certain means of discovering and recognizing the truth, also learned to protect itself from the errors that it had so often been led into by a respect for authority and by imagination. At the same time, it destroyed in the mass of individuals the prejudices that had for so long afflicted and corrupted the human species. There soon formed in Europe a class of men who were less concerned with discovering and deepening the truth than with disseminating it. Pursuing prejudices in all the safe houses, where clergy, schools, governments, and former corporations had collected and protected them, these men made it their glory to eradicate popular errors rather than to push back the boundaries of human knowledge, an indirect way of helping knowledge to advance, and not the least dangerous or the least useful way of doing so. In England, Collins and Bolingbroke, and in France, Bailey, Fontenelle, Voltaire, Montesquieu, and the schools formed by these celebrated men, will fight for the truth, using all the weapons that learning, philosophy, intelligence, and writing talent can provide, adopting every tone and using every literary form, from joking to heart-tugging, from a vast and learned treatise to a novel or mere pamphlet, covering the truth with a veil to accommodate weak eyes, leaving them with the pleasure of guessing at it, gently caressing prejudices, so as the better to aim punches at them, almost never threatening prejudices, or attacking more than one at a time, or even attacking one in its entirety. Sometimes, soothing the enemies of reason by pretending to want only half toleration in religion, and only half freedom in politics. Keeping mild relations with despotism when fighting religious absurdities, and with religious sects when battling tyranny. Striking at the roots of these deadly trees, while apparently meaning only to prune some untidy branches. Sometimes teaching the friends of liberty that superstition, which covers despotism with impenetrable armour, should be first victim to be sacrificed. And sometimes, on the contrary, denouncing superstition to despots as the true enemy of their power, and scaring them with recitals of its hypocritical conspiracies and bloody furies. Never tiring of proclaiming the independence of reason and freedom of writing as mankind's right, as its salvation. Rising up with tireless energy against all the crimes of fanaticism and of tyranny. Pursuing in religion, in administration, in manners and morals, and in laws, everything that smacked of oppression, of harshness, of barbarity. Calling on kings, soldiers, magistrates, and local officials, in the name of nature, to respect men's blood. Reproaching them with energetic severity for all the miseries incurred in battles and in punishments because of their policies or indifference. And lastly, having as their war cry, reason, toleration, humanity. Such was this new philosophy, loathed by all the many classes of men that exist only through prejudices, live only through errors, and have power only because of men's credulity. It was nearly everywhere accepted, but persecuted, having kings, priests, nobles, and magistrates as disciples and as enemies. Its leaders had almost always the skill to escape vengeance while exposing themselves to hatred, to hide themselves from persecution, while remaining in the public view, sufficiently not to lose their renown as leaders of thought. Quite often a government rewarded them with one hand, while paying their attackers with the other, condemned them, yet boasted over the fact that they had been born in its territory, punished them for their opinions, but would have been embarrassed to be suspected of not having those opinions itself. These opinions would soon be accepted by all enlightened men, openly by some, by others hypocritically concealed, with the depth of the concealment depending on how timid they were, or on how much they were influenced by the opposing interests of their profession or their vanity. But already intellectual vanity was strong enough for these men to settle, for themselves and often for others, for a merely prudent caution, rather than the deep dissimulation of earlier times. This simple system regarded unrestricted freedom as delivering the surest encouragements to commerce and industry, and freed the people from the destructive scourge, the humiliating yoke of taxes levied very unevenly and extravagantly and often barbarously. It replaced such taxes by a system of contribution that was fair, equal, and hardly noticeable. This theory, which tied the real power and wealth of states to the happiness of individuals and respect for their rights, which united by the bond of common well-being the different classes into which societies naturally divide themselves. This soothing idea of a brotherhood of the whole human race, whose gentle harmony is never to be disturbed by any national interest, these principles, so attractive from their generous spirit, as well as from their simplicity and scope, were propagated with enthusiasm by the French economists. Their success was slower and less general than that of the philosophers. The prejudices they had to combat were more refined, the errors more subtle, than those that confronted the philosophers. They had to explain before they could undeceive, and to educate good sense before they could judge anything by its standards. But if they couldn't convert many people to the whole of their doctrine, if they scared off most by the general nature of their maxims and the inflexibility of their principles, if they harmed their cause by adopting an obscure and dogmatic style, by seeming to neglect political freedom so as to focus on the freedom of commerce, and by insisting too absolutely and magisterially on certain parts of their system that they hadn't sufficiently grounded, at least they succeeded in making odious and contemptible the cowardly, crafty, and corrupt policy that places a nation's prosperity in the impoverishment of its neighbours, in the short-sighted views of a protectionist regime, and in the petty calculations of a tyrannical exchequer. But the new truths with which genius had enriched philosophy, politics, and public economy, adopted more or less by enlightened men, extended still further their salutary influence. The art of printing had been applied to many subjects, and books had opened so many doors to truth that couldn't ever all be closed again, that there was no longer any class or profession that truth could be kept out of. Accordingly, although there were still many men condemned to a voluntary or forced ignorance, the line between mankind's thick-headed portion and its enlightened portion was almost entirely erased, leaving only a gradual slope from the height of genius to the depth of stupidity. Thus, these things: a general knowledge of the natural rights of man, the opinion that these rights aren't given and can't be taken away, a strongly expressed demand for freedom of thinking and writing, freedom of industry and commerce, relief of the people's distress, repeal of penal laws against religious dissidents, abolition of torture and cruel punishments, the desire for a milder system of criminal legislation, jurisprudence giving complete security to innocence, a civil code that is simpler and more in harmony with reason and nature, lack of bias in favour of any religion, with all of them being classified as superstitions or political tricks, hatred of hypocrisy and fanaticism, contempt for prejudices, and lastly, a zeal for the propagation of truth. Passed, a little at a time, from the writings of philosophers into every class of society, whose education went beyond the catechism and the alphabet, and became the common creed, the badge of everyone who wasn't a Machiavellian or an imbecile. In some countries, these views formed a public opinion that was general enough for the mass of the people to seem ready to be directed by it and to obey it. A natural consequence of these principles was the feeling for humanity, that is, the feeling of tender and active compassion for all the afflictions of the human race, and of horror for whatever miseries public institutions, acts of government and private actions, add to the miseries inevitably inflicted by nature. This feeling for humanity seeped into every written work and in every conversation, and its benign effects were already visible in the laws and administration, even of countries subject to despotism. Philosophers of various nations, embracing in their meditations the interests of mankind as a whole, without distinction of country, race, or religion, formed a strongly united battalion against all errors, all kinds of tyranny, and they did this despite the difference of their speculative opinions. Driven by a feeling of universal philanthropy, they fought against injustice when it existed in a foreign country and couldn't harm them, and fought against it also when it was perpetrated by their own country against another. In Europe, they rose up against the crimes with which greed had stained the shores of America, Africa, and Asia. The philosophers of England and of France were glad to take the name and fulfil the duties of friends of those same blacks whose stupid oppressors disdained to count them even as men. The French writers paid the tribute of their praise to the toleration granted in Russia and Sweden. The French also tried to cure England of its commercial prejudices and its superstitious respect for the vices of its constitution and its law. While the virtuous Howard in England denounced to the French the casual barbarity that sacrificed so many human victims in their solitary confinement cells and workhouses. The violent acts of governments and their seductions lost their fatal power of suppressing the voice of truth. So did the intolerance of priests, and even the prejudices of the nation. And now nothing could rescue the enemies of reason or the oppressors of liberty from the judgment that would soon be that of the whole of Europe. Finally, Europe saw the rise of a new doctrine that was destined to give the final blow to the shaky tower of prejudices. I'm referring to the doctrine of the indefinite perfectibility of the human species, of which Turgot, Price, and Priestley were the first and most illustrious apostles. It belongs in the 10th era, and I'll expound it in that context. By comparing the disposition of individuals' minds, which I have already sketched, with the prevailing systems of government, one could easily predict that a big revolution was inevitable, and that it would have to happen in one of two ways. The populace itself would establish the principles of reason and of nature that philosophy had made so dear to them, or governments would hurry to get ahead of the populace and act in accordance with the way public opinion was moving. Of these revolutions, the former would be faster and more radical, but more stormy. The latter would be slower and less complete, but more tranquil. Simple good sense had taught the inhabitants of the British colonies that Englishmen born on the far side of the Atlantic had received from nature exactly the same rights as other Englishmen. They understood, perhaps better than the Europeans, what rights were common to all the individuals of the human race, and they took these to include the right of not paying any tax, to which they hadn't consented. But the British government acted as though it thought that God had created America, like Asia, for the pleasure of the inhabitants of London, and wanted to keep a long-distance grip on a subject nation, which in due course it was used to help it to oppress England. It commanded the obedient representatives of the English people to violate the rights of America by subjecting it to compulsory taxation. America announced that this injustice had broken its ties to England, and declared its independence. One then saw for the first time a great people throwing off all its chains, and peaceably framing the constitution and laws that it believed would do most for its happiness. Its geographical position and its political history obliged to become a federal republic, so 13 republican constitutions grew up within it, each based on a solemn recognition of the natural rights of man, and having the preservation of those rights as its primary objective. In the main work of which this is a sketch, I'll draw the picture of these constitutions. I'll show how they were indebted to advances in the political sciences, and what old errors remained, resulting from the prejudices of education. We'll see why identity of interests is adopted by these constitutions as their principle, rather than equality of rights. I shall show not only how greatly this principle of identity of interests, when made the rule of political rights, violates such rights for those who are denied the unrestricted exercise of them, but also that this identity ceases to exist at the very instant when it becomes a real inequality. I shall press this matter, because it's the only dangerous error remaining, the only error that enlightened men are still making. I'll also show how the American republics implemented the idea, at that time almost new in theory, of the need to establish and regulate by law a regular and peaceful procedure for reforming the constitutions themselves, and to separate the power to do this from the power to make laws. But in the war that broke out between two enlightened peoples, with one defending humanity's natural rights, the other countering with the doctrine that rights are subject to edicts, political interests, and written conventions, this great cause was tried at the tribunal of opinion with the whole of Europe looking on. The rights of men were vigorously maintained, and developed without reservations or restrictions, in writings that circulated freely from northwestern Russia to southwestern Spain. These discussions penetrated into the most enslaved regions, into the most remote villages, whose inhabitants were astonished to learn that they had rights. They learned to know what they were, and came to know that other people had the courage to try to win them back or defend them. So the American Revolution was bound soon to spread to Europe, and if there existed a European country, where attachment to the Americans' cause led to their writings and principles being more widely disseminated than anywhere else, at once the most enlightened and one of the least free, where philosophers had the most real knowledge, and the government had the most crass and insolent ignorance, where the laws were so far below the general level of thinking that neither pride nor prejudice would defend the old institutions, weren't the people of that country destined by the very nature of things to give the first impulse to this revolution that the friends of humanity were waiting for with so much hope and impatience? So it was bound to start with France. Its government's clumsiness hastened this revolution. Philosophy guided its principles. The force of the people destroyed the obstacles that might have slowed it down. It was more complete than the American Revolution, and consequently was less peaceful. The Americans, satisfied with the code of civil and criminal law they had received from England, not having to reform a corrupt system of taxation, and not having to destroy feudal tyrannies, hereditary distinctions, privileged, rich or powerful corporations, or any system of religious intolerance, had only to establish new powers to replace the ones the British had previously exercised over them. Nothing in these innovations made any difference to the mass of the people. Nothing changed the relations that had formed among individuals. In France, the conditions were opposite to those, so that the revolution had to take in the whole economy of the society, to change every social relation, to work down to the smallest links of the political chain, right down to individuals who, living peacefully on their fortunes or by their industry, weren't connected with public affairs by their opinions, their occupations, or any concern for fortune, ambition, or glory. Because the Americans appeared to be fighting only against the tyrannical prejudices of the mother country, they had as open allies the powers that were rivals of England, while other nations, jealous of England's wealth and pride, made secret treaties which unintentionally aided the triumph of justice, so all Europe seemed to be united against the oppressors. Whereas the French revolutionaries attacked, all at once, the despotism of kings, the political inequality of half-free constitutions, the pride of the aristocracy, the domination, intolerance, and wealth of the priests, and the feudal abuses that still covered most of Europe. So it was attacking all the powers of Europe that were really united on the side of tyranny. France had in its favour only the voice of some wise men and the timid prayers of the oppressed peoples, and calumny has since worked hard to deprive it of even those small helps. I shall show why the principles on which the Constitution and laws of France have been brought together are more pure, precise, and profound than the ones that directed the Americans, why they have escaped much more completely from the influence of all sorts of prejudices, how in them the equality of rights is never replaced by that identity of interests, which is nothing but its feeble and hypocritical substitute, how in them limits on powers have been put in the place of that long-admired but empty balance of powers, how in a large nation dispersed and divided into many separate and partial assemblies, they dare for the first time to let the populace keep its right of sovereignty, the right to obey only laws whose manner of formation by trusted representatives is legitimized by the immediate approval of the populace. Laws which, if they harm its rights or interests, the populace can always reform by a regular act of its sovereign will. During this era, the picture of the advances of the mathematical and physical sciences presents us with an immense horizon. We'll have to sort out and order its various parts, if we are to have a good view of their interrelations and a good grasp of the whole. The application of algebra to geometry generated discoveries in both those sciences, and it was advance notice that the methods for computing magnitudes in general can be employed successfully on all topics where precise valuation is possible. This great discovery, by showing for the first time the ultimate aim of the sciences, namely to bring strict calculation to bear on all truths, gave hope that this would be achieved and a glimpse of how. This was soon followed by the discovery of a new method of calculating that lets one find the rate of increase or decrease of a variable quantity, or to find the quantity itself when this rate is given. This method applies to all the combinations of variable magnitudes and to all the hypotheses concerning their variations. So it enables us to determine, with regard to everything whose changes are precisely measurable, either the relations between the elements when only those between the objects are known, or the relations between the objects when only those between the elements are known. The discovery of these methods is due to Newton and Leibniz, the way to it having been prepared by geometers of the previous generation. The methods in question have been advancing uninterruptedly for more than a century, through the work of several men of genius. To a philosopher who observes them, even if he can't follow them, these methods present a striking monument to the powers of the human mind. Rational mechanics soon becomes a vast and deep science. The true laws of the collision of bodies, which Descartes was wrong about, are finally known. Huygens discovers the laws of circular motion, and at the same time he gives a method for determining, for any point on any curve, the circle it belongs to. By uniting these two theories, Newton found the theory of curvilinear motions. He applied that to the laws that Kepler found the planets to obey in their elliptical orbits. A planet launched into space at a given instant, with a given velocity and direction, will follow an ellipse around the sun by virtue of a force directed towards that star, the force at any moment being inversely proportional to the square of the distance between the sun and that planet at that moment. The same force retains the satellites in their orbits around the primary planets. It pervades the whole system of heavenly bodies, and acts reciprocally between all their component parts. This force is the cause of many things, including the weight of terrestrial bodies. It appears to be constant in them, because we don't get to observe them at sufficiently different distances from the earth toward which they are being pulled. So at last, man has come to know one of the physical laws of the universe. It is the only one so far, and in this uniqueness it matches the glory of him who discovered it. The discovery of this general law of nature may not have been Newton's only contribution to the advances of the human mind. He also taught men to allow in physics only theories that are precise and open to calculation, theories that give an account not only of a phenomenon's existence, but of its quantity and extent. Yet he was accused of reviving the occult qualities of the ancients, because the general cause he offered for celestial phenomena was a simple fact, which observation had incontestably proved to be real. This accusation shows how greatly the methods of the sciences still needed to be enlightened by philosophy. Many problems in statics and dynamics had been successively proposed and resolved when D'Alembert discovered a general principle that can determine, all on its own, the motions of any number of points acted on by any forces, and related to each other by certain conditions. He soon extended this same principle to finite bodies of a determinate shape, to elastic or flexible bodies which can change shape, but only according to certain laws, and preserving certain relations among their parts, and lastly, to fluids themselves, ones that keep the same density and ones that can expand. A new calculation was needed to resolve these last questions, but D'Alembert's genius was up to that, and mechanics is now nothing but a science of pure calculation. These discoveries belong to the mathematical sciences, but the natures of the law of universal gravitation and of the principles of mechanics, consequences of it, apply to the eternal order of the universe and belong to the province of philosophy. We learn that all bodies are subject to necessary laws that tend unaided to produce or maintain equilibrium, cause or preserve the regularity of bodies' motions. Astronomy's advances are assured by the combined working of several causes: knowledge of the laws that govern the celestial phenomena, the discoveries in mathematical analysis that lead to the most precise methods of calculating the appearances of those phenomena, the hitherto undreamed-of perfection to which optical instruments have been brought, the precision of machines for measuring time, the more general liking for the sciences, which, combined with the interest of governments, leads to an increase in the number of astronomers and observatories. For man, the heavens are enriched with new stars, and he knows how to determine and predict with accuracy their positions and their movements. Physics, gradually escaping from Descartes' vague explanations, just as it previously cleared itself from the absurdities of the scholastics, is now nothing more than the art of interrogating nature by experiments for the purpose of afterwards deducing more general facts by computation. The weight of air is known and measured. The transmission of light is found not to be instantaneous. Its velocity is determined. The effects of that velocity on the apparent positions of the celestial bodies have been calculated. Sunlight is broken down into distinct rays of different colours that bend differently when they go through a prism. In this way, the rainbow is explained, and the methods of causing its colours to come or go are subjected to calculation. Electricity, formerly known only as the ability of certain substances to attract light bodies after being rubbed, now becomes known to be one of the general phenomena of the universe. in depicting these discoveries, I'll show how the methods that physicists have used in their researches are purified and perfected, and how the art of conducting experiments and making instruments has become ever more precise, so that not only is physics enriched every day with new truths, but also the truths already known have been more exactly ascertained, and not only have vastly many new facts been observed and analysed, but also all of them have been submitted to stricter measures in their details. The advances of chemistry were held back by two obstacles that physics was spared. It had been thought that chemistry ought to provide the secret of making gold, and that of making man immortal. The effect of caring passionately about something is to make man superstitious. The two strongest passions of vulgar minds, to make gold and to live for ever, weren't thought to be achievable by ordinary means, so all the extravagances that delirious credulity had ever invented seemed to come together in the minds of chemists. But these fantasies gradually retreated in face of Descartes' mechanical philosophy. Although that itself was rejected, it cleared the way for a truly experimental chemistry. The observation of the events that accompany the composition and decomposition of bodies, research into the laws of these operations, and the analysis of substances into more and more simple elements became ever more precise and strict. Men who for so long had had no way of explaining the formation of the earth except by superstitious or philosophical daydreams before they started trying to understand it properly have at last felt the need to study carefully both its surface and the substances they have found by digging down into it, the random or regular distribution of those substances, and the disposition of the masses they have formed. They have learned to recognize in the earth the traces of the slow and long-continued action of the sea, of rivers, and of volcanic fires, and to distinguish those parts of the surface and outer crust of the globe where inequalities have been produced by sea, rivers, and magma. The physical man is himself the topic of a separate science, anatomy, which in the word's general meaning includes physiology. This science, which had been held back by a superstitious respect for the dead, profited from the general weakening of prejudices, and it enlisted, against those prejudices, the support of powerful men, who had a concern for their own health. It has advanced so far that it seems in a way to have dried up, to be waiting for more perfect instruments and new methods, and to be nearly reduced, today, to seeking in comparisons between the parts of animals and the parts of man, the organs that different species have in common, and the ways in which those organs exercise similar functions, truths that the direct observation of the human body appears to refuse. Almost everything that the eye of the observer, aided by the microscope, has been able to discover is already revealed. Anatomy appears to need experiments, so useful to the progress of other sciences, but the nature of its object deprives it of this means that is now so evidently necessary for its further improvement. The circulation of the blood was already known, but the layout of the vessels that carry the chyle to mix with the blood and make good its losses, the existence of gastric fluid that readies the ingested food for the decomposition needed to separate out what the living fluids and the organized matter can assimilate, the changes undergone by the various parts and organs in the interval between conception and birth, and then postnatally during the different ages of life. These are things that physiology has been able to discover during this brilliant era, relying on indubitable observations. These important truths should secure forgiveness for the mechanical, chemical, and organic explanations that have succeeded each other and burdened this science with hypotheses harmful to its progress and downright dangerous when medical practice is based on them. To the picture of the sciences, we should add that of the arts. Now that they are based on the sciences, they have advanced with a surer tread, and broken the shackles of routine which had previously held them back. I shall show how advances in mechanics, astronomy, optics, and the art of measuring time have influenced the art of constructing, moving, and directing vessels at sea. I shall show how an increase in the number of observers, greater skill on the part of navigators, and more rigorous accuracy in the astronomical determinations of positions and in topographical methods, have at last let us know at first hand this globe of which almost nothing was known at the end of the last century, and how greatly the mechanical arts, properly so called, have owed their improvements to improvements in the art of making instruments, machines, looms, and how much these improvements have owed to advances in rational mechanics and physics. These arts are also indebted to the science of using already known machines more cheaply and efficiently, and to the invention of new machines. We'll see architecture draw from the science of equilibrium the way to give the most commodious and least expensive form to roofs without fear of altering their solidity, and from the theory of fluids the means to calculate more securely what is needed to hold a given body of water in place, to direct the course of water, and to use it in canals with greater skill and success. In the meantime, chemistry, botany, and natural history spread a productive light on the economic arts, on the growing of plants and trees to meet our various needs, on the art of feeding, propagating, and preserving domestic animals, bringing their races to perfection, and improving their products, on the art of preparing and preserving the productions of the earth or of animals. From the moment when anatomy and chemistry give them clearer and surer guides, surgery and pharmacy become almost new arts. Medicine, which in its practice should be considered as an art, is at least delivered from its false theories, its pedantic jargon, its murderous routines, and its servile submission to the authority of men and the doctrines of colleges. It learns to trust nothing but experience. Medicine has increased the means at its disposal, and learned how to make a better job of combining and using them. And though some of its advances are in a way negative, consisting in the abolition of dangerous practices and harmful prejudices, the new methods of studying chemical medicine and of combining observations are a promise of more positive and extended advances. Separate sciences can't be extended without coming closer, without forming points of contact. An account of the advances in each science will show how useful the direct application of mathematics has been in several of them. I could go on at vast length giving details, but I shan't do so here, restricting myself to just one branch of mathematics. Applications of the calculus of probabilities foretell how much they can contribute to advance the sciences, in one context enabling us to determine the likelihood of extraordinary factual claims, teaching us to judge whether they are worth looking into, in another enabling us to calculate the likelihood of the constant recurrence of those facts that often present themselves in the practice of the arts, and don't fall under any recognized general law. The mathematics of probability has also taught us to recognize the various levels of certainty we can hope to achieve, the probability that an opinion needs if we're to adopt it and base our reasonings on it, without harming the rights of reason and the rules of our conduct, that is, without offending against justice or lacking in prudence. Probability theory also shows what the advantages and disadvantages are of various forms of election, various ways of basing a decision on the number of votes supporting it, the different levels of probability that may result from such proceedings, the level of probability that public interest should demand for a given question, and the means for dealing with different kinds of case. These applications include the examination of the probabilities of factual claims for those who aren't in a position to rely on their own observations in the given case, the probabilities that result either from the testimony of witnesses or from the connection of those claims with others whose truth has been immediately observed. Then there are inquiries into the duration of human life, the influence on longevity of differences in sex, temperatures, climates, professions, governments, and lifestyles, into the death rate from various diseases, into changes in population numbers, into how much various causes contribute to these changes, into the distribution of the populace in each country according to the age, sex, and occupation, how useful these researches can be to the physical knowledge of man, to medicine, and to public economy, how much the calculus of probabilities has been used by the part of the public economy that concerns the establishment of annuities, private savings banks, benefit schemes, and insurance policies of every kind. Isn't that calculus also needed for the part of the public economy that deals with the theories of measures, coinage, banking, financial operations, as well as taxation as established by law, of actual taxation, often not the same thing, and of the effects of both on all parts of the social system? How many important questions there are in the science of public economy that couldn't have been properly answered without help from knowledge acquired in natural history, agriculture, botany, and the mechanical and chemical arts. In short, such has been the general progress of the sciences that it's virtually true that not one of them could be completely grasped in its principles and its details by someone who didn't get help from all the others. If I confine myself to exhibiting the advantages that have been drawn from the sciences in their immediate use, I would have shown only a small part of their benefits. The most important benefit may have been to destroy prejudices. The human understanding had been forced into strange postures by absurd beliefs that had been drilled into each generation from its infancy by the terrors of superstition and the dread of tyranny, and the destruction of prejudices enabled it to stand up straight, so to speak. Errors in politics and in morals all arise from philosophical mistakes, which are connected with scientific errors. Every single religious system, every supernatural extravagance, is based on ignorance of the laws of nature. The inventors and defenders of these absurdities couldn't foresee the gradual improvement of the human mind. Convinced that the men of their time knew everything they could ever know, and would always believe what they believed then, they confidently relied for their fantasies on the current opinions of their country and their time. The advances in physics are all the more fatal to these errors, because they often destroy them without seeming to attack them, and they subject those who obstinately defend the errors to the taunting label, ignorant. At the same time, the practice of reasoning soundly on the topics of these sciences, and what their methods provide in the way of precise ideas and ways for recognizing or proving truths, must naturally lead us to contrast the frame of mind that forces us to stick to opinions based on these real sources of credibility, with the one that attaches us to our habitual prejudices or forces us to yield to authority. This contrast is all we need to become suspicious of the latter opinions, to give us a sense that they aren't really believed, even when belief in them is proudly proclaimed and declared with the purest sincerity. When this secret is discovered, their abolition follows quickly and inevitably. In short, this progress of the physical sciences, which aren't disturbed by passions or self-interest, and don't allow that someone who can't understand a given topic is nevertheless entitled by his birth, profession, or government position to make judgments about it, couldn't have been observed if enlightened men hadn't kept working to bring the other sciences closer to the physical sciences. The latter's progress, at every step, offers these men the model they ought to follow, a standard by which they could judge their own efforts, recognize the wrong routes they could have taken, preserve themselves from extreme skepticism as well as from credulity, and from a blind mistrust or a too complete submission to the authority, even of men with knowledge and renown. Metaphysical analysis, doubtless, would have led to the same results, but it would have provided only abstract principles. In the physical sciences, the same abstract principles, put into action, are clarified by examples and strengthened by success. Until this ninth era, the sciences had been the birthright of only a few. Now they had become common property, and the moment was approaching in which their elements, their principles, and their simplest methods would become really popular. That is when their usefulness, to the arts and to the general health of men's minds, would be truly universal. I'll trace the advances of European nations in infant and adult education. Up to now, the advances haven't amounted to much. If we attend merely to the philosophical system of this education, which has nearly everywhere been given over to scholastic prejudices. But they have been very rapid if we consider the extent and nature of the content, which now includes hardly any knowledge that isn't real, and takes in the elements of almost all the sciences, while men of all ages find in dictionaries, abstracts, and journals the knowledge they need, although it isn't always of the purest kind. The picture of the fine arts offers results that are no less brilliant. Music has become, in a way, a new art, while the science of combinations and the application of mathematics to the vibrations of sounding bodies and waves in the air have clarified its theory. The graphic arts, which had already passed from Italy to Flanders, Spain, and France, were raised in France to the same level they had had in Italy in the preceding era, and were acclaimed even more strongly than they had been in Italy itself. The art of our painters is that of Raphael and the Carracci family. All the means of that art have been preserved in the schools. Far from being lost, they have spread. But it's a long time since any genius comparable to them has appeared, too long for this period of sterility to be attributed to chance. It's not because the methods of graphic art are exhausted, though it really has become harder to achieve great success in it, nor is it because nature has denied us organs as perfect as those it gave the Italians of the 16th century. It is solely to changes in politics and manners and morals that we should attribute not the decay of the art, but the mediocrity of its productions. Literary productions, cultivated in Italy with less success, but without having degenerated there, have made advances in the French language, advances which have entitled it to the honour of becoming, in a way, the universal language of Europe. The art of tragedy in the hands of Corneille, Racine, and Voltaire has been raised step by step to a previously unknown level of perfection. Comedy is indebted to Molière for having more quickly reached a level not previously achieved by any nation. The English language was perfected from the start of this ninth era, as was the German language, more recently. In both languages, the art of poetry, as well as that of prose writing, have been brought, though less completely than in France, under the universal rules of reason and nature that ought to direct them. These rules are equally true for all languages and all peoples, though up to now, few men have been able to know them and rise to the sound and sure taste that is nothing but a sense of those rules. That sense presided over the compositions of Sophocles and Virgil, as well as those of Pope and Voltaire. It taught the Greeks and Romans, as well as the French, to be struck with the same beauties and shocked by the same faults. I shall show what has helped or hindered the advances of these arts in each nation. By what causes the various kinds of poetry or prose works have reached such different levels in the different countries, and how these universal rules can, while remaining true to their own fundamental principles, be modified by the manners and morals and opinions of their intended audience, and even by the uses to which their different genres are to be put. I'll show how printing, publishing, and disseminating works, even ones intended to be publicly read or recited, enables them to reach incomparably many more readers than they'll have hearers. How, because nearly all the important decisions by large assemblies were taken after the members had been briefed in writing. The rules for the art of persuasion among the moderns were bound to be different from those for the ancients, matching the differences in the effect aimed at and the means employed. And lastly, how those rules differ between ancients and moderns, even for matters such as history and philosophy, where the ancients also relied on reading, because the invention of printing made it easy for the moderns to learn about more developments and get more details. The advances in philosophy and the sciences have helped and extended the advances of literary pursuits, and these have served to make the study of the sciences easier and philosophy more popular. There has been mutual help between the sciences and philosophy on one hand, and literary pursuits on the other. Despite the efforts of ignorance and folly to disunite them and make them enemies. Scholarship, with its obedience to human authority and respect for anything ancient, seemed sure to support the cause of harmful prejudices, but in fact, scholarship has helped to destroy them, because the sciences and philosophy have lent it the torch of a sounder criticism. It already knew about weighing and comparing authorities, but now, at last, it has submitted them to the tribunal of reason. It had rejected miracles, absurd tales, factual claims contrary to probability, but now, in attacking the testimony on which these relied, it has learned to reject that testimony, however much of it there is, unless it outweighs the physical or psychological improbability of the extraordinary factual claim in question. Thus, all men's intellectual occupations, however different in topic, method, or mental qualities required, have collaborated in the advances of human reason. In fact, the entire system of human intellectual achievement is like a single well-built piece of work. Its parts, though carefully distinguished from one another, must nevertheless be closely connected so as to form one whole and work towards one goal. Surveying the human species, I'll show that the discovery of true methods in all the sciences, the scope of the theories they include, their applicability to all natural objects and all human needs, the lines of communication established among them, the great number of people who cultivate them, and the spread of printing presses, are sufficient to assure us that no science will ever sink below the level to which it has been carried. I'll show that the principles of philosophy, the maxims of liberty, and the knowledge of the true rights and real interest of man are spread through too many nations, in each of which they direct the opinions of too many enlightened men, for them ever to fall back into oblivion. The two most widely used languages, French and English, are those of the two peoples who have the most complete liberty, and have best known the principles of liberty, so that no confederacy of tyrants, nor any possible political conspiracy, can prevent the rights of reason and of liberty from being openly defended in both languages. So, what is there to fear now? But if everything assures us that the human race won't relapse into its former barbarous state, if everything ought to guarantee us against that feeble and corrupt system that condemns mankind to eternal oscillations between truth and error, liberty and servitude, still we see enlightenment spreading over only a small part of our globe, leaving the rest in ignorance and prejudice. We see vast territories groaning under slavery, containing only nations degraded by the vices of a civilization that can't progress because it is so corrupt, and nations still vegetating in the infancy of their first eras. We see that the exertions of these last ages have done much for the progress of the human mind, but little for the perfection of the human species. Much for man's glory, something for his liberty, but hardly anything yet for his happiness. The philosopher's soul can peacefully take satisfaction in a few things, but more often it is afflicted by the spectacle of stupidity, slavery, wildness, and barbarism. The only way a friend of humanity can have unmixed pleasure is by abandoning himself to hopes of a lovely future. Such are the topics that belong in an historical picture of the advances of the human mind. In presenting them more fully, I shall aim to emphasize how these advances have affected the opinions and the well-being of the populace in the nations in which they have occurred, to show on one side what truths those folk have known, what errors they have been cured of, what virtuous habits they have acquired, what new improvements have brought their faculties nearer to satisfying their needs, and on the other side, what prejudices have enslaved them, what religious or political superstitions have been introduced, what vices they have been dragged down to by ignorance or despotism, what miseries they have suffered through violence or their own degradation. Until now, political history, like the histories of philosophy and the sciences, has been merely the history of a few men, the real substance of the human species, the mass of families that live almost entirely on their labour, has been forgotten. And even among those whose professional occupation was to instruct, govern, defend, and comfort other men, only the chiefs have attracted the attention of historians. For the history of individuals, all one needs is to collect facts, but the history of a mass of men has to rely on observations, and in order to select these and grasp their essential traits, the historian needs to have considerable knowledge already, and to make a proper use of them, he needs philosophy. Another point. These observations relate to common things that are perfectly visible. Anyone who wants to can find out about them for himself. So nearly all that have been collected have come from travellers, because things that are very trivial in the place where they exist have aroused the curiosity of foreigners. Unfortunately, these travellers are nearly always inaccurate observers. They see objects too quickly, through their own country's prejudices, and often by the eyes of the locals. They consult people they happen to meet, and the answers they get are nearly always dictated by the answerer's self-interest, party spirit, national pride, or mood. The gap can be filled only very imperfectly by knowledge of laws, practical principles of government, public economy, religions and general prejudices. In fact, the differences between the written law and the actually applied law, the principles of those who govern and the way their governing is shaped by the frame of mind of the governed, the institution in the minds of the men who formed it and the actual institution that results, the religion of the books and the religion of the people, and the apparent universality of a prejudice, and the facts about who actually has it, can be so great that there comes to be absolutely no match between the effects and these public and known causes. This part of the history of the human species, the most obscure, the most neglected, and the least supported by records, is what should be emphasized most in the picture I am drawing, whether the topic is a new discovery, an important theory, a new system of laws, or a political revolution. The task will be to discover what its effects must have been on the most numerous portion of each society, for that is the true topic of philosophy, since all the intermediate effects of these same causes can only be regarded as means of eventually acting on this portion of humanity that truly constitutes the mass of the human race. It is when we reach this last link of the chain that the observation of past events, as well as the knowledge acquired by meditation, become truly useful. Only when reaching this stage can men appreciate their real claim to glory, or get durable pleasure from the advances of their reason. Only then can anyone judge regarding the true improvement of the human species. This idea of relating everything to this last point, that is, to the welfare of the mass of people, is dictated by justice and by reason. One might be tempted to regard it as chimerical, but it isn't, and it will be enough here to show this by two striking examples. First, the man who cultivates the soil has an abundance of food to meet his needs. He owes this to the continued exertions of industry, aided by scientific knowledge. So ultimately, he owes it to the victory of the Greeks over the Persians in the Battle of Salamis, without which the darkness of Oriental despotism threatened to cover the whole of the earth. Second, the sailor who is saved from shipwreck by the accurate observation of longitude owes his life to a theory that descends through a chain of truths from discoveries made in the school of Plato, and buried for 20 centuries in total disuse. End of Era 9. End of this reading.